Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 15th day of April 2016. I'm Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the impact that El Niño, as it transitions to La Niña, has on yields in the United States. We'll discuss that with Scott Irwin, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. By the way, I'm out of the office today, and this is the last day of the week, so we'll be back on Monday to pick up where we left off on Tuesday afternoon with the CME Group numbers, but no numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Later in the program, we'll also take the final look at our three-part series in the production and domestication of the soybean, kind of a history of the soybean. Ted Heimowitz, who is a professor emeritus of crop sciences, will join us as we finish out this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Again, just a reminder that I'm out of the office this afternoon, so no update of the numbers for the day from the CME Group in Chicago. In a moment, we will be joined by Scott Irwin to talk about the impact El Niño, as it transitions to La Niña, has on yields in the United States. He and Daryl Good did some research about that to discover just exactly the real correlation between corn yields, soybean yields, and that transition after an El Niño year, especially if it peaks as it did this year in the end of the previous calendar year. So make sure you stick with us for that. One other note, thank you. Thank you so much for listening to our programming. It means a great deal to myself and to all of our analysts. On their behalf, again, thank you for listening to the programming content that comes to you from willag.org. If you've got any suggestions, you can always contact me. Just look me up on the web. I'm usually the first one that comes up. The name is Todd Gleason, of course. It's tgleason@illinois.edu. Or you can dial me up at 217-333-9697. That's 333-9697. Now on with the show, the Closing Market Report on this Friday afternoon from Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, dedicated to improving the quality of life for Illinois farmers by offering financial products and services geared specifically to the farm community and developing partnership-based relationships with its agricultural customers, helping farm families succeed for 100 years.
Our term of the day is hedge as it relates to agricultural commodity price hedging. A typical hedger might be a commercial farmer, so the market value of wheat, for instance, and other crops fluctuates constantly as supply and demand for them vary, with occasional large moves in either direction. Based on current prices and forecast levels at harvest time, the farmer might decide that planting wheat, for instance, is a good idea one season, but the forecast prices are only that, forecast. Once the farmer plants wheat, he's committed to it for the entire season. If the actual price of wheat greatly rises between planting and harvest, the farmer stands to make a lot of unexpected money. But if the actual price drops by harvest time, he could be ruined. If at planting time the farmer sells a number of wheat futures contracts equivalent to his anticipated crop size, he effectively locks in the price of wheat at that time. The contract is an agreement to deliver a certain number of bushels of wheat to a specified place on a certain date in the future for a certain fixed price. The farmer has hedged his exposure to wheat prices. He no longer cares whether the current price rises or falls because he is guaranteed a price by the contract. He no longer needs to worry about being ruined by a low wheat price at harvest time, but he also gives up the chance at making extra money from a high wheat price at harvest time. However, in the case of a farmer, it must be noted that the hedge introduces another kind of risk. If the farmer has contracted to sell all his expected crop but then has a bad year, for instance, a year with lower than expected yields, such that his farm is not able to produce the committed quantity, he may have to purchase replacement crop at a disadvantageous price to fulfill his futures contract. And that's our trading term for the day, hedge, as it relates to agricultural commodities.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at agrigold.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office this afternoon. A really good interview on tap for you today. I talked with Scott Irwin. He and Daryl Good wrote an article for the Farm Doc Daily website. It was posted there on the 16th day of March about El Nino and how it impacts corn and soybean yields. What about the transition to La Nina, and what does that really mean? It caused quite a fervor, I think, didn't it, Scott Irwin, in Chicago?
Seems like everybody's got a strong opinion about El Nino and corn yields.
So tell me about the marketplace and the article that you've written. You went back and did a whole lot of history to begin with to get at what the impact of weather, in this case El Nino, has been historically. Not in just the short term, but over quite a long period of time.
Right. We went back 56 years to 1960, and we started off by updating our trend yield estimate from last year, and then asked how we might alter our trend yield expectation based on knowledge of the El Nino event that's ongoing.
So tell me about the historical yields and patterns to kind of set the stage.
Right. We use a long-term trend. Our argument is that the technological rate of improvement in corn yields in the U.S. in aggregate has been remarkably stable for over five decades. That corn yields have increased a little bit over 1.8 bushels per year, going all the way back into the early 1960s. There's always a lot of debate about, is that increasing? Some people a few years ago thought it was decreasing. Daryl and I think that we should stick with the long run. And when we put all the numbers together, that gives us a trend yield for 2016 of 166.2 bushels per acre.
Yeah, and so the 166.2 is actually, is it just slightly lower than one of the other trends that you use? So it's 164 plus an adjustment, is that right?
Right, right. So literally, if you just take the yields for the last 56 years, run a straight line through those yields to represent trend, and then just project one more year with that straight line, that's actually 164.2. But we've done some other research over the years with crop weather models, and it turns out that there's a slight bias to your trend coefficient estimate if you don't account for this asymmetry of weather effects that we see in corn and that every corn farmer knows in their bones, which is that good weather helps you less than bad weather, hurts your yields. And that rolls through these statistical modeling, gives you a slight downward bias. So we adjust up the 164.2 to 166.2 as our final estimate of what the true trend yield should be for the U.S. on average.
So then you have to put it all back together with the trend and the deviations over time. And
right.
What does that look like so that we can get closer to where we're headed?
That's right, because obviously, there are very few years when yields turn out to be exactly equal to trend because the trend forecast is basically assuming average weather. And do we very often get truly average weather? No, it's typically either better than average or sometimes much worse than average. And so that gives us dramatic deviations normally. So we wouldn't expect to actually get 166.2 next year, but that's the best you can project based on assuming no knowledge of what the growing season weather will be.
You mentioned that the expectation is for yields to be normal, and that the good yields don't help as much as the bad yields hurt, but bad yields don't appear as often, is my gut feeling.
And that's exactly right. Kind of a round number, but think of it this way, Todd. About 60% of the time, yields are above trend, and about 40% of the time, they're below trend. And you would think, well, that can't work because don't those deviations have to add up to zero? Yes, they do. What we see in the data makes a lot of sense is that the negative deviations below trend tend to be larger than the positive deviations so that they still add up to zero. Kind of the best way I think to see that is just look at the extremes. And the according to our figures, the largest deviation positive above trend was in 2004 at about 18 bushels. And can still remember it, really good year for growing corn in the U.S. But in 2012, just the opposite, we were, I believe, 33 bushels below trend. So you can see that not quite twice as big of an extreme for the downside compared to the upside.
Okay. So,
so
now,
that's normal. That's normal.
Now we understand the normal, we understand the deviation and the trend and what the expectation would be. Then you have to also understand the oscillation from La Nina to El Nino.
Right.
And definitions of both, actually.
Yeah. So the real question is then, so we see 166.2 is what we project, and then we know that there's this range of possible deviations from the 166.2 from a really good year like 2004 to a really terrible year like 2012. That's kind of what we call in statistical terms the unconditional risk, yield risks that we face going forward. And now what we want to ask is, should we skew our expectation of those risks given this outside factor that doesn't happen every year, which we call El Nino?
And should we?
Bottom line is, jumping ahead, yes. That's what our research suggests, somewhat. So what we did is went back to what is exactly an El Nino. Lots of people probably already know this, but it's a complex climatological effect. But ultimately, what it really is warming temperature of waters on the surface of the Pacific near the equator. And it's kind of fascinating, although it's widely studied, we really don't understand why these El Nino, La Nina cycles have occurred. We now know they've been around for thousands, maybe tens of thousands or longer years. But what we're just now in the last couple of decades beginning to appreciate is the dramatic effects on short-run weather that these cycling of the sea surface temperature around the equator in the Pacific can have when they're warmer than average or colder than average. And that's the cycling between what is called El Nino and La Nina conditions out in the Pacific.
And we base that on centigrade. And I thought it was unique when I was reading through the article that Indonesia seems to be the place that takes the brunt of the impact. Mm-hmm. Either they have a lot of rain or don't have a lot of rain, depending on whether we're in a strong El Nino or a strong La Nina.
Right.
And this oscillates, but it has impacts across other parts of the world, including here, potentially in the Midwest. So I think we're now at the point where we can begin to talk about what the growing season might look like in the United States. And we can, again, use that based on historical factors.
Right. So, all right, that all sounds really simple, right? Digging into it, we found out there are two things that you have to think about. One, exactly how are you going to define an El Nino event? There's basically two kinds of El Nino variables. One that is most straightforward and most people use is strictly a function of the water temperature near the equator in the Pacific in two specific regions. Other measures take into account air pressure and other variables for these kind of composite indicators. Looking into it, we have a preference for keeping it as simple as we can. And so we strictly focused on measures of that are based strictly on water temperature, which are measured, as I understand it, by buoys out there in the Pacific that measure the water temperature. And it's been set up by various scientific agencies. And so that's the measure that we're looking at to determine it. And the standard definition of an El Nino is when the temperature for 3 consecutive months running on average is at least half a degree centigrade above the average norm for that area. And inversely, you have what's called a La Nina when you're at least a half a centigrade below the average temperature in that region. And so that's how you define an El Nino or a La Nina.
How many times does this happen then?
Oh, a lot. If you look at...
The pattern's what, every 6 years? 6 to 7?
Again, that depends. Now you get into the second part of the definition. Because there's a lot of El Niños and La Niñas using the half a degree threshold. So what we were interested in is, so what we did is basically just plotted the data for these temperature anomalies, as they're called. And naturally, we think that the data is most interesting in the extremes. So that's what we did. We limited our attention to what I would call El Nino spikes, the really big El Nino phenomenon. So we decided to only look at El Nino episodes that were at least 1 degree centigrade above the average temperature. So it could be 1 degree or more warmer than normal. And the warmest one was to date was 1997-98, and it peaked at 2.3 degrees centigrade above normal. So when we take the same period, we estimated trend yields. If you look going back to 1960, there were 11 El Nino episodes where we were at least 1 degree centigrade above normal. And this is the other key. We filtered the data so that these spikes had to occur in what we called the preseason period for corn production. So from September of the calendar year previously through March, we're looking for basically a spike of a big El Nino. And that's exactly what we're experiencing this year. We don't have final data yet. It looks like the current El Nino is spiking. It's peaked in either December or January near 2.3 or 2.4 degrees above normal. So it's a really big one. And it occurred in the preseason period. And then we asked, okay, is there anything systematic between that occurrence and the deviation above or below trend that we experienced the next summer?
And did you find anything?
We think we did. Again, it's not definitive. Every one of these things is a little bit different in how they occur. But basically what we find is that in these big spiking El Niños that occur in the preseason period, that in corn, on average, you end up about 4 to 5 bushels below trend on average. But having said that, there's quite a range of occurrences. There are instances of these big preseason El Nino spikes where you actually end up fairly substantially above trend. 1 year, I recall, I think it was 1992, you ended up, I believe, 11 bushels above trend. And you also see other years that are in there that are, you know, kind of the big ones that we talk about. And the ones that people really pay attention to are 1982-83 was one of those big spikes in the preseason El Nino, and we ended up 23 bushels below trend. And of course, there's 87-88, which is the second biggest deviation after 2012. There are other years there that range from small positive to smaller negative deviations, but on average, the data say that your expectation, based on the kind of El Nino that we're currently experiencing, you would want to certainly take into consideration what we call elevated risks of below trend yields. It's not a sure thing, but the data clearly point in that direction.
They do, and in fact, not a sure thing, because, for instance, the 1997-98 El Nino, the largest one to record to date at 2.3 above centigrade, was a 3-bushel increase in the average trend yield or deviation from the average.
And I think the thing that's missing that we really didn't talk about in our article is that, particularly in these really big El Ninos, what they tend to predict pretty reliably is a major summer heat wave. Not a lot of predictability about precipitation. It's hard to connect that, but you're going to get probably next summer, the odds really favor a fairly significant heat wave, but the timing of it can be critical. For example, in 1997-98, we had a major heat wave, but it occurred very late, August, September, after the crop was already made. 82-83, another very comparable one. The heat wave came early and just fried the crop. So I think what we can say is it's probably going to be a much hotter than normal summer, and it's going to be depend on a combination of whether we get anything near normal precipitation, and when the heat hits will be what will determine what 2016 ultimately turns out to be.
And very quickly, then, the takeaway is that there is more risk in this year's production than there have been in previous years, based solely on the strength of the El Nino, and that that might show up as a premium at some point in the marketplace.
That's right. What's interesting is anyone watching the market prices could certainly tell that doesn't seem like there's much of this kind of enhanced yield risk is built into a weather premium in the marketplace. So despite these kind of facts, it'll be interesting to see as we go through the springtime if the market builds in any more weather premium or not.
Scott Irwin, thanks so much.
My pleasure, always.
That was University of Illinois agricultural economist Scott Irwin. You can find his article on the impact of El Nino on the FarmDoc Daily website. That's at farmdocdaily.illinois.edu. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office this afternoon. Again, thanks for listening to our programming. This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. You may find us online at willag.org. The address again is willag.org.
Support for WILL comes from the Friends of WILL and from Busey. Whether out of town or out of time, with Busey's mobile, deposit checks, view balances, and pay people and bills from your device. Busey, your dream, our promise.
It's National Pecan Day. Pecans are native to North America and is a member of the hickory family. During the 1700s and the early 1800s, the pecan became an item of commerce for the American colonists, and the pecan industry was born. Today, the U.S. is responsible for more than 80% of the world's pecan crop. Astronauts took pecans to the moon during two Apollo space missions. By the way, it would take 10 billion pecans stacked end to end to reach the moon. On this day in agricultural history in 1927, Clarence Birdseye of Massachusetts received a British patent for frozen fish fingers. As a trapper and biologist in Labrador, Birdseye had noticed that fish and caribou meat, frozen for months, tasted just as good as fresh fish and meat. The secret was to duplicate these sub-zero temperatures in nature. Birdseye spent 8 years trying to recreate the effects of nature until he developed a satisfactory commercial system for quick freezing. And in 1964, Rachel Louise Carson died, an American biologist. Carson was well known for her writings on environmental pollution. In her book, Silent Spring, Carson warned about the long-term effects of misusing pesticides, especially the dangers of DDT. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this 15th day of April. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Up next, our third in the three-part series on the history of the soybean, we talked with Ted Heimowitz, who is a professor emeritus here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of I. I like to call him the wild soybean hunter, as part of his career was traipsing around the great continent of Australia and parts of China looking for relatives that might have genes you could find useful in the soybean today.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
In 1758, Samuel Bowen signed on as a sailor with a ship called the Pitt. He was an Englishman. The ship sailed to India and then on to Hong Kong. From there, says plant geneticist Ted Heimowitz, Samuel Bowen signed off the Pitt and onto a ship called the Success. Well, Heimowitz and a friend spent 2 years tracking Mr. Bowen's movements by researching the University of Illinois library. Anyway, the Success, says Heimowitz, sailed north from Hong Kong to Tientsin, China.
There, the ship was captured because the British were not supposed to be trading other than in Hong Kong, and the emperor was annoyed. The ship was never seen again, probably sunk. And Mr. Bowen and those people on the ship were held hostage, Mr. Bowen writes, for 3 years. He was held a hostage. And eventually imprisoned in Hong Kong, actually Macau, next door.
Samuel Bowen was eventually released and made his way back to the colonies, in this case, Savannah, Georgia. He brought with him a bag of beans, soybeans. It was the mid-1760s. Now, Mr. Bowen was something of an entrepreneur. In 1767, Bowen was issued a royal patent for soy sauce. He'd acquired some property in Georgia and was growing and pressing soybeans into sauce on a farm he called Greenwich. The sauce was grown for export to England.
And it was quite a business. He was an entrepreneur because he also had the idea of crushing peanuts for oil. And in fact, we have records that he did it. So he was an entrepreneur. Unfortunately, he died 10 years later, and in 1777.
Despite his death, Bowen had managed to leave a legacy. The soybean. The first recorded evidence of the bean in the United States belongs to him. The minutes from a 1765 meeting of the Philadelphia Society for the Promotion of Agriculture acknowledges the receipt of 6 bottles of soy and seeds of Chinese vetch from Samuel Bowen. And that is one story of how the soybean arrived in North America. There are others, and Ted Heimowitz harbors one of them, but they cannot be proven. So it's a ship called the Success, Chinese imprisonment, and Samuel Bowen that are credited with the introduction of the soybean to North American farmers. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.